title of my message for you this evening from John 1, 1 to 14 is an extraordinary Jesus. Just think for a moment, if you could meet anyone in the world, someone extraordinarily important, who would that be? Who would you like to meet? Would it be a world leader like him? Would it be an upcoming athlete like Gal Gadot? Would it be a cultural icon like Nelson Mandela? And very quickly, would it be her? The Apostle John wants to introduce us this evening to someone infinitely greater than any celebrity or hero. He wants us to meet the most extraordinary person that has ever walked the face of this earth. Here's how John puts it in John 1 and verse 14. The Word became flesh and he made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John wants us to meet the Word made flesh. John is not merely giving us information, he's giving us an invitation to meet the Word made flesh, to behold his glory, and to ultimately come to know him. And John, later in his gospel, tells us why he has written these things. These things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. This passage before us is not meant to be skimmed or mastered. It's meant to leave us blown away by the presence of glory and truth and grace. Here's the first of my headings for you. An extraordinary echo. You know what an echo is, don't you? Here's a definition. An echo is a sound or sounds caused by the reflection of sound waves from a surface back to the listener. John begins with words that are very, very familiar to most of us. In the beginning. It's an echo that's reverberating back all the way to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, where we're told in the beginning, where we're told that in the beginning God made the heavens and the earth. Back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, God speaks light and life. He speaks life into darkness. He speaks life into the emptiness by his word. But John surprises us. Instead of saying, in the beginning, God, he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Greek word for word is logos. In the beginning was the logos. And the logos was with God and the logos was God. And then, down in verse 14, John makes one of the most staggering claims that's ever been written. The Word, the logos, became flesh. The eternal Word, the agent of creation, God himself becomes flesh. I wonder if you can hear the echo this evening. Creation is not just spoken into existence. Creation is now stepped into by its creator. But this extraordinary echo is met by an extraordinary rejection. John, in our passage, makes it very clear to us that this incredible revelation is not received universally by all. In verse 5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. But look at this rejection in verse 10. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. The created did not and does not receive her creator. And it's both non-Jews and Jews, both back then and now, that struggle with this. For the Greeks back then, here's how they understood the Logos. The Logos was an impersonal organizing principle behind the universe, the impersonal reality behind all that happens, that which injects coherence and stability into the universe. Modern day equivalents would be things like, well, God is just the higher power, or he's the energy force in the universe. Greeks also believed, as many do today, that when you die, in the words of the philosopher Plato, that death releases the human soul from its miserable captivity in a fleshly body, setting the soul free. As someone said, the Greek mind could no more conceive of the Logos becoming flesh than the Word becoming mud. And yet echoes of this thinking and these patterns remain today. The idea that the soul just escapes the body, that heaven means shedding our humanity, and that God would never ever truly enter our mess. For Greeks and people today who wish to shed the flesh and fly to heaven, John says that heaven put on flesh and came down to us. For Jews, the problem was different, but no less profound. When the Jews read that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God and was God, they knew exactly what John was saying. To the Jewish minds, that meant that Yahweh, the God of Israel, becoming human. The one who met Moses at the burning bush and said, I am who I am, that one becoming human. The God who took Israel out of Egypt and led them to the promised land through the wilderness, that one became human. The transcendent one, the only being who cannot be lumped with any other creation, becoming man. The creator becoming a creature, the one who molded the clay becomes the clay pot. The author of history writes himself into the story. The Jews read this and it makes them choke. They understood what John was saying. The God of Israel, the one who is, I am who I am, the Almighty One, the El Shaddai, Jehovah Jireh, Adonai, Elohim. This God becomes man, which for the Jews becomes the extraordinary scandal. And so in one short statement and expression, John unveils the greatest truth at the heart of Christianity. God becomes man. One of the great authors of our time, C.S. Lewis, wrote a book called Mere Christianity. And if you haven't read it, it's a tough read, worth reading. Let me quote what he said. He said, among the Jews, there suddenly turns up a man who goes on talking as if he were God. He claims to forgive sins. He says he's always existed. He says he's coming to judge the world at the end of time. Now let's get this clear. Among pantheists like the Indians, anyone might say he was part of God or one with God. There would be nothing very odd about this. But this man, since he was a Jew, could not mean that kind of God. God in their language meant the being outside the world who made it and was infinitely different from anything else. And when you've grasped that, you will see that what this man said was simply the most shocking thing that has ever been uttered from human lips. I have a Jewish friend that simply cannot fathom that the God of Israel became a man, and he chokes every time I tell him. Rejection, confusion, offense, these things are nothing new. And yet the light keeps on shining. What about you? What is your response this evening? Rejection, confusion, offense, or faith? If you struggle to believe, you are not strange. Greeks thought it was nonsense. Jews thought it was scandalous. Doubt does not disqualify you, but it does ask for a response. Doubt does not disqualify you, but it does ask for a response. John takes us a little deeper into what I have called an extraordinary dwelling. Have a look at verse 14 again. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. That word dwelling can be translated tent or tabernacle. It literally means to pitch a tent. I'm not a tent fan, not tenting, just putting it out there. Glamping? Caravan, okay. No sleeping under the stars for me unless it's 5 stars. The Logos, the Eternal Son, the Word of Life, the Son of Man, put on flesh and came camping with us. It's deliberate. John is precise. He's intentional. The tabernacle or the tent in the Old Testament was the place where God met with his people, where he dwelt with them. The tent was guarded. It was holy. It was restricted. Access was limited. God's presence was real, but it was entirely contained. The Word became flesh and made his tent tabernacle among us. The Jews would get the association immediately. They would immediately think of that portable temple, that portable tent that was transported by the Levites wherever the Israelites went through the wilderness into the promised land. In the Old Testament, tent or tabernacle, that was the place where the immortal met the mortal. It was the place where the eternal intersected with the temporary, where the supernatural collided with the natural. It was the place where the divine met with the fleshly, but so temporarily. But with John saying that the Word, the Logos, tabernacled among us, he's saying something breathtaking, that Jesus is the new tabernacle. He is the new tent. God no longer dwells in a tent or a tabernacle. He dwells in a human body. Here's how Paul puts it in Colossians chapter 2, verse 9. He says, "For in Christ all the fullness of deity lives in bodily form." So in the Old Testament, the supernatural would collide with the natural in a tent. John tells us now that the supernatural collides in a human body with unlimited access, where human beings can meet God always with his glory. This really is some kind of wonderful. This really helps us to understand, I think, why the religious leaders in the time of Jesus, why they were so freaked out when Jesus claimed to be God. God God allowing himself to touch and be touched by lepers, by menstruating women, Samaritans, tax collectors, and prostitutes, and all the other so-called undesirables of society. You see, in the Old Testament tent, in the Old Testament tabernacle, the sick, the deformed, the lepers, the eunuchs, the menstrually unclean, they weren't allowed in. But in the New Testament tent, in the New Testament tabernacle in Jesus, the sick, the deformed, the unclean, oh, he welcomes them, he touches them, he kisses them, he hugs them, and he heals them. Listen to what John said a little bit later in one of his letters, in 1 John. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The eternal God could be seen, could be touched, could be heard, and he did not recoil. He did not recoil from sinners. He welcomed them. This also speaks to those of us here this evening that after another busy and a hectic year, we're exhausted. Not spiritually dramatic, but tired. I can say that I know that with you. The incarnation says that God does not shout instructions from heaven. He comes close. He comes and camps with us. In our disappointments, in our grief, in our unanswered questions. I don't know about you, I do love Christmas. And one of the greatest things about Christmas, especially if you have young children around, is to watch little children open their presents. And usually if they've got lots of presents, and they squeal with delight as they rip open the stuff and see what's in there. The incarnation should really make us squeal with delight as we receive this gift that has come to us from heaven. So fourthly, an extraordinary delight. It is just so easy, isn't it, to become very familiar with Christmas. And the incarnation, the word become flesh, the logos become flesh, it can sometimes become something of a background noise. Back in 1995, before some of you were even born, there was a song, some of you might remember it, by Joan Osborne. And I remember it well, and the song was called What If God Was One of Us. Anybody remember that one? A few of you out there. The chorus line went like this. What if God was one of us? Just a slob like one of us. Just a stranger on the bus trying to make his way home. Many of the lyrics in that song highlighted the possibility of God being the hungry, being the thirsty, being the homeless, that divinity may reside in those who are marginalized in society. And therefore, it was rightly criticized by Christians as being disrespectful of God. But as so often the case, that song went to number one in 20 countries. The song was intended to provoke, but it did trivialize what most people think in the world is a stupid myth, that God became flesh. It was C.S. Lewis again who said, he spoke of the incarnation as the humiliation of myth into fact, of God into man. The humiliation of myth into fact. What a delight. What a delight. Here's a quote from a guy called Dane Ortlund. The word, the logos, the central meaning of the universe, the integrative center to reality, the climax and the culmination of all human history, that which summoned the solar systems into instant human history at just the right time became a helpless baby. This is some kind of wonderful. the night that baby Jesus was born, wrote the author G.K. Chesterton, said the night that Christ was born in Bethlehem, the hands that made the sun and the stars were too small to reach the huge head of cattle. My hope and my prayer for you this evening is that the Logos made flesh, the incarnation, would become for you an extraordinary delight. That you might banish those doubts that you have that the God of Israel could become a man. Staggering? Yes. Incomprehensible? Yes. Figure outable by human reason? No. Mystery? Yes. Delightful? Absolutely. Which takes us then to an extraordinary restoration. As we follow the Logos who tabernacled among us, as we follow him through the gospel, as we follow the one who took on human hands, human feet, and a human mouth, we see him breathing new life into broken bones. The blind saw, the lame walked, demons who don't belong in humans are exorcised. The dead are raised, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the mute speak, and the bleeding stops. In other words, the Logos came to restore us to what we were meant to be. And one day he will restore things, all things, to what they were meant to be. So I want to say to you this evening, to those of you that would touch and see and feel the Logos made flesh, to those of you that would see him on the living pages of Scripture, your brokenness will not be forever. Your pain will not last. Your suffering will not have the last word. Death will be banished, and the devil will not slither into the new creation. Here's Dane Ortlund again. I'll just read it to you. The incarnation is not something to be mentally downloaded on and moved on. We do not master this like a multiplication table. It is a pot to be chewed on and digested. It is to be wondered at the Word made flesh. This was another portable temple, though this time not carried around by priests, but on his own two legs. This calls for meditation, and this calls for worship. So to number 6, the extraordinary death. I am often asked why at every single Christmas I always bring up the death of Jesus. Well, the answer is simple, but it's profound. There's no crucifixion without the incarnation. There is no resurrection without incarnation. There's no second coming without the first. Jesus came as the second Adam, undoing what Adam had done in disobedience and doing what Adam had failed to do, namely be obedient. Think about this. In becoming a man, the eternal Son leapt from the safety of heaven and plunged into the world to save a world from drowning. I hope I've got this quote from a guy called Athanasius. I hope he's on here. He said, quote, "He descended that he might raise us up. He went down to corruption, that corruption might put on immortality. He became weak for us that we might rise with power. He descended to death that he might bestow on us immortality and give life to the dead. Finally, he became man that we who die as men might live again, that death should no more reign over us." It is some kind of wonderful that the Creator became created, became creature to die in our place, so that we can be restored to the Creator. It really is an extraordinary death. Which leads me to my final point. an extraordinary grace. John 1:14, one more time. The Word became flesh and tabernacled, tented among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. I wonder this evening whether you can get just a glimpse, just a little glimpse of the glory of God who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. I don't know if you are someone that likes to negotiate a deal. Like, you know, one of those big ticket items that you have to buy. Any negotiators out there? Any hagglers out there? There's probably one or two of you at least. I love a good haggle. I love a good negotiation. You know what it's like, don't you? Get in that Facebook, put it on Marketplace, you put the price up, you get the low ballers, right? They come in, toss them out. But somewhere you always get offered lower than what you want, and somehow you haggle, and somewhere you might land somewhere in the middle, and everybody thinks they got a good deal. God doesn't meet us halfway. He comes all the way to us. He becomes one of us so that we can go all the way back to God. God's grace in Jesus is this: I will become what you were meant to be. Maybe some of us here this evening, we're still in that little bit of a haggle with God, a little bit of a negotiation, that sort of self-improvement or promising improvement or offering effort. What Christmas tells us is that God does not negotiate. He just gives us all of his grace as a gift. The incarnation is the grace of God writing himself into the story of human history. Do you remember? Some of you will know this little encounter between Jesus and the disciple Thomas. It's after the resurrection. Jesus says to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands. Reach out your hand and put them into my side, Thomas. Stop doubting and believe." Stop doubting and believe. Thomas responds like this: "My Lord, my Lord and my God, my Lord and my God." But then look at what Jesus says in response. Then Jesus said to Thomas, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. But blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." I wonder if this evening, are you blessed because you have believed? I want you to try and see and feel the glory, the truth, and the grace of Jesus in these two scriptures. But we do see Jesus, who was made lower than the angels for a little while, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. The question very simply this evening is this: has Jesus tasted death for you? Has Jesus tasted death for you? Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil. Has Jesus broken the power of the devil over you? Has Jesus broken the power of the devil over you? Back in September this year, I went to go and see my mom in South Africa, and it's a long flight back there, and lots of time to watch movies on the plane. But one of the things that was showing, being South African Airways, was a documentary on the late Archbishop of Cape Town, the Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He was something of a religious and a cultural icon in South African history. He had a famous line that ran through his life, and in fact, picked up in the book that he wrote, but also it ended the documentary that I was watching, and this is what he said. He said, "We are all God's children. We are all God's children." Not quite. Not quite. He didn't get that right. Because John says, he came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God. He said, it's to those who receive the extraordinary Jesus, to those who believe in the extraordinary Jesus, they become the children of God. Remember why John wrote that these things are written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. You could sit here tonight and you could admire the incarnation and still refuse it. John says the dividing line is not understanding it so much, but receiving it. Have you received? Have you received the extraordinary Jesus? Have you received the Logos made flesh? Have you received the one who is some kind of wonderful? I hope you have.